Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fuck nicks, what the fucksters, what the fucking nucks, what the fucking avians?
Today, the amazingly talented Jack Antonoff is on the show. And Jack is, his bands were initially Steel Train, then the band Fun, which I think it was last year. Won the Song of the Year for We Are Young and also the Best New Artist. The song Carry On was also a big hit. These are pop songs. This is not my world. This is not my wheelhouse, but I'm not unable to appreciate it. Particularly Fun. I mean, I get it, man. I mean, it's no easy trick to write a song that makes millions of dollars or to get millions of people to like your song. It's a real gift. And this guy, Jack Antonoff, has that gift. He does perform at the end of the show. He does an acoustic version of one of the new songs off of the Bleachers debut album. This is his post-Fun project, which is more just Jack. And that Bleachers, that debut album, Strange Desire, is available now. And they're going to be on tour this summer and fall. You can go to bleachersmusic.com for more info. And he does play. And Jack is appearing courtesy of RCA Records, which is a division of Sony Music Entertainment. But I will tell you this about it. You know, when I talked to this guy, I didn't know a lot about him. But I generally will go, a friend mentioned that he liked my show and that I would love him. And that friend was Lena Dunham, who is Jack's significant other. And I'm like, all right, well, I'll check him out, Lena. I'll check him out. And I went and bought all the records. And I listened to all the records. And I'm like, oh, my God, this guy's got a gift. He's got a songwriting gift. He's got a very earnest approach to lyric writing. It feels real to me. And also the sound, the evolution of the sound of his work from Steel Train through Fun on into Bleachers it's a phenomenal arc of style. Like, how did he get from one place to the other? So I was sort of fascinated with him. And after we had a conversation, I really feel like, you know, this guy is one of these rare people that has a true gift, an amazingly talented guy, and very articulate.
I'm looking out of a window in New York City. I don't know. You know, I miss New York all of a sudden. I lived here for years. I don't know if I could live here again. I don't know if I could afford it. I don't know even if I could, even if I did have the means to do that. I don't know if I would do that because that's just the way I am. I'm afraid to spend money. Look at that. They're digging a hole. Oh, you can't see it. I'll tell you, man, New York City, no matter what time of day or night, there's always some guys with hard hats in a hole doing some maintenance, keeping the pipes and veins, arteries together underneath the ground. God knows what's underneath this ground, but it can't be in good shape. There's always dudes in holes with tractors and tools. I always find that fascinating. That New York is just giant, crumbling, organic entity that requires constant maintenance. And they seem to do it. They seem to build things that it never stops. All eras of architecture are represented. That's for sure. But somehow it all makes sense because New York can absorb it. Like, even if there's this big modern piece of shit right over there, unattractive, right next to it, there's something probably from the 20s. But, you know, in some places, if they build some modern piece of shit, it will just destroy the entire environment of the entire town. But here, it's just sort of like, yeah, we got room. The other buildings are sort of like, yeah, let that guy hang out. It's all right. He's not showing us up. It's a little embarrassing. That's an impression of a building I just did. This guy thinks he's a hotshot. That's all right. I've been here a long time. These hotshots come and go. Oh, it's terrible. Should be ashamed of himself. The vanity of that vestibule. Fuck these new guys. Again, an impression of a building. I think that what I should do is perhaps go out into the street. That would be good. I should go out into the street. Why don't I go out into the street? Oh, let's go out and let's walk around New York a little bit and see what happens. Let me interface with the city and then dump my brain into this mic for you. Okay, I'm out in it. I'm on Bowery and 3rd. Let's go down 3rd Street. I used to live down here, but further down, and I always gravitate towards the Lower East Side. I don't know what it is. I have no interest in uptown at all. It's sort of like in Los Angeles as well. I live on the East Side. I don't have, you know, if I have to go to the West Side, it's like a tremendous chore, and I have to pack a bag and probably a tent. I think genetically I'm supposed to be down here. I think if you're a Jew, am I really going to bring that into it? Is that possible that, you know, just my proximity to Orchard Street and what is it, Hester Street, that there's some part of my my biology that is compelled to those blocks from when it was, just people with, you know, pickle barrels and strange snacks on carts? I don't know. Maybe. I don't really know. But I'm walking down 3rd Street towards where I used to live. I don't know. It doesn't seem that much different. I think I get creative ideas when I wander around the streets of Manhattan, because the last time I was here, I became obsessed with the ground. Like, you know, there's like at the bottom of lampposts or planters or around mailboxes on the ground in New York, there's always this very odd collection of garbage and trash and, you know, pieces. I mean, it's the middle of the summer. And the last time I was here, like, you know, like what here? I'm right by some sort of sewer grate or like a drainage grate. There's a Hershey's wrapper and some cigarette butts and a sticker. But the last time I was here, I kept getting obsessed with the bases of lampposts, thinking like, wow, I should do a photo. Like here's a hairnet and half an apple. But I became sort of obsessed with the bases of lampposts. Is like, well, if you frame that properly and you had a good camera, that'd be sort of an abstract art photograph. So I was, I pictured an entire series of photographs of just, you know, well-framed bits and pieces of weird garbage. See? That's what I could have been doing. Why didn't I dedicate my life to that? It's the middle of summer. Like, look at right here. Like, why is there a pair of gloves in this garbage here? Why is that? What's going on? Where'd they come from? What's the story? What's the backstory behind the winter gloves in the middle of summer at the base of a lamp? You know, the Hell's Angels headquarters, I think it might be further down on 2nd or 3rd Street. They actually have a building here in New York. This is where their corporate headquarters are. And I always liked walking by it. It always gave me a weird feeling, but also the feeling of something historic. Like, you know, something nostalgic from the 60s. It's like, I had no idea they had a franchise here in New York. Of course they have a franchise there. Well, franchised organization. But, you know, you don't see many storefronts. You know, Hell's Angels storefronts. Holy shit, there it is. There it is. Yep, I guess it's still open. It's a big sign out front, Hell's Angels, New York City. The Hell's Angels on the door. Hell's Angels, New York City. Yeah, it's there it is. That's their clubhouse. Looks exactly the same. They've got some cones out in front. Oh, there's a chopper. They've got some cones out in front. A couple bikes parked out front. Yeah, it's just, you know, just a clubhouse. It's where the fellas hang out. Wow. Why is that? I don't know why that moves me one way or the other. I guess it's sort of ominous and kind of interesting. It's been there forever. I used to walk by it all the time because we're heading down to where I used to live. Oh, look, there's some more garbage organized in a unique way. Oh, I remember what the name of my exhibition would be called. It would be called Look Down, Abstract Photos by Mark Maron, Random Assemblages of Artifacts Discarded on the Sidewalks of New York. That's it. That's the gallery card. And then you'd see the photograph. It'd be the gloves, maybe a rusty key, and some cigarette butts. I used to spend my life just trying to find a fucking parking space on the Lower East Side. Your car would get broken into for a nickel down here. And they used to, you just sort of knew in this neighborhood that you didn't park in front of this storefront where the doorway was, where the dope doorway was. And one night I was like, fuck it, man. I can't find a space. I'm parking in front of the dope doorway. And I did that. And then I woke up in the morning and my tires were all flat. And there was a bunch of dudes standing around, including the little scary old man. And I'm like, what the fuck? And they're like, yeah, man, look what happened to your car. I'm like, well, yeah, what happened to my car? Knowing I was talking to the guys that did it. And they're like, I don't know. Maybe you shouldn't have parked here. Great. I get it. All right. And, you know, it's weird when you have this relationship with, you know, criminals in your neighborhood. You want to try to keep the peace and you want to try to have an understanding. And I'd somehow cross the line. And I'm like, all right. And he's like, then one of them goes, you're going to need tires, bro, you know? And I'm like, where the hell do I get tires? And I'm like, there's a place around the corner. And I'm like, all right. So I go around the corner to an affiliated criminal operation of some kind to get temporary tires. And I come back and two of these dudes who flattened my tires were now in my car going through my glove compartment. Now, the real question about that scenario is like, why did I trust that to them to watch the car? I mean, what the, I must have been out of my fucking mind. Yeah, I got the tires. I never parked there again. But it's an exciting time. It was an exciting time living down here. We go around the corner and go see the street where I used to buy Coke from Jimmy. Lived upstairs, the ongoing cocaine salon. So for me, what I used to do is I used to try to get there early. Like I used to try to get there before the night really started. I used to try to get my Coke, you know, like at 5 or 6 in the afternoon on Friday or Thursday or Wednesday or whatever it was. So in my mind, so I could get it all done, you know, by the nighttime, get it past me, get beyond it and hide it from my wife at the time. But there's this one time where there's a great Lower East Side memory. I used to go get a bindle of Coke and then I'd go down to 7A or no, this bar down here and just knock back a pint. There's nothing better than, oh boy, I think I'm getting the drips. There's nothing better than doing those first few lines of Coke and then just having a cold pint of Bass Ale by yourself at a bar with your brain on fire. Ah, oh, Jesus, I better go to a meeting. Oh, here's another weird composition of garbage. What is that? What are those? Oh, they're like lychee nut shells. See, it's surprising if you look at everything with an aesthetic eye, you know, you can see the beauty in things. See, some people would just walk by this and see it as garbage, which I'm about to. But for a moment there, it looked like art. Yeah, so, okay, so I'd go over there early. And one time I went over to Hammerhead's. You know, it was like a 6-floor walk-up. And it was a lair. It was like a complete sort of like, you know, abstract art, insane man cave situation up there. All kinds of art and action figures and weirdness and darkness. But I went up there like 5:36. So I get there. He let me in. And I walk up the stairs. I'm like, come on, man. Let's go. What do you got? And he's like, I don't know. I don't know. The guy hasn't come yet. So, like, my guy's guy hadn't come yet. And so I'm like, all right. Well, so we go into the back room where he used to, you know, where the couch was and all the stuff was and where he'd sort of have his little cocaine salon, people coming by. He was a good Coke dealer. He'd always put stuff out. He'd step on it, but it was nice to, you know, have a place to sit and talk and sweat. So I get there. It's like 5:36. We go in the back. It's still light out, and he closes the blinds to, like, sort of get set up for the night. And the buzzer rings, and a guy comes, a little guy, a little Latino guy with a ponytail, shows up and speaks to Hammerhead in Spanish. And, you know, obviously, this was something that happened regularly. And hands him this wad of tinfoil. And then goes away. This short, old Latino. He must have been in his 60s. The ponytail and the cap. Gives Hammerhead a wad of tinfoil, and then walks away. And then Jimmy brings it into the back and opens it up, and there's just this rock of cocaine, you know, like bigger than a golf ball-sized rock. So this is the main stuff. This is the stuff right off the brick from wherever that comes from. So my coke dealer's guy had just delivered my guy his stuff in pure form. So Jimmy and I are sitting there, and I'm like, wow, that's it, huh? That's it? That's the real stuff? He's like, yeah. And I'm like, well, let's do some. He's like, all right. So he cut me up a couple lines of this stuff right off of this rock, right out of the guy's hands. I do two lines of this stuff right off of this rock, and I just felt electricity ripple up from the top of my sinus passages all the way down my spine, and just like, oh, everything just like little tingly explosions all over my body, and I felt like I could fly. I felt, I just, oh, okay. And I look at Jimmy, and I'm like, holy shit. Why don't you sell that stuff? And he looked at me, and he said, because people would never leave me alone. And then I watched him take this golf-size rock of cocaine and drop it into a bag of stepped-on garbage from last night and just pound it all out into whatever he was going to sell. There's sadness to it. There was a sadness to it. But I also understood it. And I'm glad that I had no real access to whatever the hell that Latino guy brought over. Because, boy, God knows where I'd be. God knows where I'd be right now.
Hey, Mark.
Hi. Thanks, man. What's going on?
Nothing much. Selling beer.
Selling beer here?
Yeah.
I was just talking about this place.
Yeah, 7B.
I'm walking around, so I'm doing...
Doing a little tour of the old neighborhood?
Yeah. Because I was just talking about going down there to get my blow and coming right here to have the first beer after I got jacked at his house and how beautiful it was.
Yeah, it still is.
Oh, no, don't tell me that. Don't tell me that.
I'm sure it hasn't changed at all.
Why? I don't need to go back there. I'm coming up on 15 years sober. I want to get out of here now. Okay. See you later, buddy. Don't worry, folks. That was a dramatization of a possibility. I have no desire to go down that street and walk into whatever the hell I was in 20 some odd years ago. Holy shit, 25 years ago almost. I gotta be honest with you, Tompkins Square Park, it's nicer. It's definitely nicer. Feels warm. It's nice. It's nice. I'm just gonna go down and see if he's there. I'm back. I made it back to the hotel. I did not go to my old drug dealer's house to see if he was home. That was done for effect. I did not even want to go over there. There was no part of me. All right. Maybe a little part of me. But I'm back in the room safely. Had a nice walk. And this week's episode tonight of Marin on IFC is called White Truck. It was based on a fairly dicey story I told some of you here on the show probably a couple of years ago about being in a particular situation that was not safe, nor was it pleasant. And that's all I'm going to give you. I will give you this, though. My friend and fellow Prince of Darkness, Mr. Jerry Stahl, wrote tonight's episode. And you can definitely feel the Jerry Stahl vibe on tonight's episode of Marin. So watch that. Enjoy that. Thank you so much for watching the show. Next week, the episode I directed, The Joke, is on. And it was very important to me that I directed that because it deals with a very dicey, challenging topic of joke theft, where that comes from. Let's go now to my conversation with Jack Antonoff.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Off.
What were we saying about blues? It's sad that it's hard to listen to because what is it about it though?
I don't know. I think it's so fun to. It's like jam band music too.
Right.
Like I could jam for hours.
Right.
But if I had to listen to it, it would be terrible.
Well, yeah. I mean, but it's because it's predictable. But there's some things that you know. There's some blues guys who are like, that's pretty good. But you're right.
It's not for every mood.
No, it's not.
You have to be high for jam band music, and you have to be in a specific, like, third phase of anger from a broken heart to enjoy blues.
Right. Or you have to be like, I'm just going to fucking do it.
Yeah, or, like, blues needs, like, a setting. Like, you'd have to be in, like, a specific car on a specific road playing
some
blues for it to feel right.
Yeah, you have to direct your life around the blues music.
You can't put it on at any point.
But who are your guitar heroes?
I love Jack White.
Really?
I love Jack White. A lot of my guitar heroes aren't...
He's a
blues man, but
he's a noise man.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
I love Tom Waits as a guitar player who doesn't get referenced a lot.
He doesn't get referenced a lot. What's that guy's name? Mark Rebo usually plays a lot for him. You like Mark Rebo?
I love Mark Rebo. I love the Afrobeat stuff he does.
Uh-huh.
It's almost like good Santana.
Right.
Because Santana had that, you know, there's that famous performance at Woodstock. And then to me, everything else after that sucked, but that was so cool.
Well, on one of the Steel Train albums, you basically do Santana.
Basically.
Which song is that?
It's
you know, like, exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, that was the album I did. I did this, I was into drugs at that point in my life. I'm very clean now, but on that album, I worked with the producer who did American Beauty. We went to Northern California.
Yeah, David Grissom. Is that his name, Grissman?
Yeah, so it was all
Is it Grissman?
It's Grissman.
Yeah, well that, so you're like, let's go all out.
Yeah.
Let's fucking do it.
And that was the last time I ever go to a destination studio because I think you lose yourself.
Seriously.
Yeah, you gotta be home listening to the shit you did on the speakers that you listen to things normally.
But is that how you're gonna explain that first Steel Train album?
Definitely.
That you lost yourself? That you were impressionable? That Dave Grissman bullied you into playing hippie music?
No, I bullied myself into doing an album that I couldn't stand behind years later.
Really? It's a sweet record, but like, I mean, let's go back though. You say your last name Antonoff?
Yeah.
You're a Jewish kid from New Jersey.
In every way.
Yeah, I mean, I my roots are New Jersey, not Bergen County. You're from Bergen County?
Yeah.
What town?
I was born in New Milford.
New Milford.
And then I think my parents made more money and then we moved to a town called Woodcliff Lake.
Woodcliff Lake. Yeah. My family's from Morris County, I think.
I know it.
You do?
Yeah.
Pompton Lakes.
I know it.
You know Pompton?
That's not far.
Right, exactly.
It's like 20 minutes.
Do you know the Milk Barn?
No.
Oh, it's probably gone. It's an ice cream place, I think on the Hamburg Turnpike.
I know the area.
Yeah. So yeah, my grandfather owned an appliance store and a hardware store, Pompton Lakes, New Jersey. My mother grew up there.
I used to go to Pompton Honda and Suzuki to buy trailers for my 15-passenger vans when I would do tours.
You just buy a trailer for the tour?
No, I just over the past 15 years of being in a van, I've bought like 6 or 7 different trailers.
At Pompton?
Yeah.
So you know New Jersey?
Very well.
New Jersey's very lush in the summer. It's humid.
New Jersey is a wonderful place specifically because of its proximity to the greatest city in the world.
That's right.
And that's why it's so special. Everyone from New Jersey always feels like they're looking in the window of the party.
Right. But you can leave the party, unlike people who are stuck at the party forever.
Totally.
So you can just go home and crawl into your bed with your posters and your headphones and be okay.
I didn't realize how special it was till I got older and moved to New York City.
How special the distance was?
Yeah, because everyone I met that was from New York City had like done all the drugs, had all the sex, seen all the bands by the time they were 13.
It was over.
Yeah, and I'm 30, and to this day, I still think it's so cool that I live in New York City.
Yeah, it's amazing. I remember going to visit my grandmother because I grew up in New Mexico, so I'd go visit her in Jersey. And at that time, when I was like 14, 15, she would let me take the bus into Port of Authority by myself and just do a day in New York City. Just put a kid on the bus from New Mexico and knock yourself out. Go wander around Times Square. And it was nasty then.
Yeah.
When I think back on it, when did you start going in alone?
Started going in alone in the 96-ish.
How old were you, like 15, 16?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we go to the West Village. It wasn't nasty or dangerous, but it was all transvestite hookers who would get in your face. You know,
way west.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Christopher Street was the real scene then.
Yeah. And why'd you go there?
I don't know.
That just seemed like that's where we're going to go in New York to see what's really happening.
You know what I was really into a little bit later, but I saw Hedwig in the Jane Street Hotel basement when that first happened.
Right.
And I think I just got excited by that culture and wanted to be around it.
Sure. How many siblings you got?
I had two. Now I have one's dead.
That's sad.
Yeah.
What happened?
My youngest sister about 11 years ago died of brain cancer.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's terrible. Yeah. It's just the worst thing ever.
I'm sorry.
But now, so there,
it's okay.
Spill so much so early on. It's just, we have this argument a lot in my family because when you get that question, it's like, what do you say?
Yeah.
This is fair because this is not a light moment as much as like when someone's like, oh, like,
yeah, right,
how
right,
many, you know,
right.
So I usually just say like, oh, I have a sister.
Right.
Because it's just not
leave
worth
the other
it.
Part out.
But I figure we're going to talk for a minute.
How long ago did she die?
11 years.
It's a long time.
It's a very long
time.
Was
she young?
She was 13 and I was 18.
Wow. That's a rough time.
My entire life is based off of that moment. It's music, everything.
How so?
Because it was the single most monumentally important thing that has ever happened to me and probably will ever happen to me.
Yeah.
And so I've, you know, my whole life, it's just like a, you know, something froze there. And I think I'm constantly looking back on it and dealing with it just from a different lens. So I feel like I'm 30, I'm dealing with that at 30. At
right.
40, I'll be dealing with that. I don't think that goes away. I wouldn't want it to go away. It's
that feeling of loss.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's also, I mean, at the point when most people are, I think, going to college and having this sort of freewheeling moment in life, I missed that.
Right, because you were consumed with...
Which I think was formative for me.
And how long was she ill for?
Her whole life, but not like... She would not have appeared sick. She just kind of went in and out of being sick.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
And that was taken away from you. And what kind of family did you grow up in?
A good one.
Yeah?
Yeah, my parents and my other sister, Rachel, were all... I mean, it's kind of hard to remember everything before that, but we're extremely close.
Mm-hmm. Still?
Yeah. Like, I talk to every member of my family a number of times a day.
Really?
I would not be able to go to sleep if I didn't have contact with each and every one of them saying, like, love you, night.
Really?
Yeah.
And is that something that happened after your sister passed away?
Absolutely.
Because there's maybe a little bit of worry and panic and appreciation?
A lot. Yeah.
Like, we don't want to lose any more.
Totally. If we lose any, I don't know what I was, that wouldn't work for me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's interesting. So there's this like almost compulsive need to connect as often as possible.
Very much.
Still alive. Hi, Mom.
Yeah, and it's not like sometimes it's like we're all in bad moods, but we're connecting.
Right.
Like that
right.
part's just inherent. It has to happen.
Alive, but not happy.
There's nothing I love more than a still alive text. Do you have people in your life where you're just wondering if they're dead, or is that more my thing?
Just me.
Okay.
Whenever I go to sleep at night these days, I'm like, what am I going to, is it going to be a tomorrow? So it's,
a stressful thought for you or just a question?
I don't know. Like I turned 50 and I didn't think it bothered me.
You look good.
I appreciate that. But lately I've been like, you know, having these weird physical symptoms and I'm nervous and I'm becoming hypo, you know, a little, I used to be a hypochondriac and now it's sort of back and it's like, it's driving me nuts.
I'm with you.
You are? You have that?
Terribly.
Really?
It's, I've battled with a lot of OCD mm-hmm. and not in the annoying way where people are like, I'm so OCD, like, you know, real issues where.
Like how did that manifest itself?
The biggest way it manifests, well, it was always just little things, you know, like organizing, counting. But as I've gotten older, it's gotten worse. And the biggest way, I was so terrified. I had a terrible acid trip, which is another very formative thing. So to stay sort of chronological, about 3 years after I lost my sister, I was in like a totally post-traumatic stress place. And
right.
I was doing some drugs. I did acid and it totally freaked me out. I had like the quintessential bad trip.
The first time you did it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I became completely convinced if I did it again, I would lose my mind. I'd become a schizophrenic or whatever. And then I became completely convinced that I was going to get dosed because I was playing a lot of festivals.
So you're going to get sandbagged by some idiot.
Ruin my life.
And then lose your mind.
And so then I became obsessed in this very obsessive way about not drinking anything that wasn't sealed. I wouldn't drink water to rest.
Out of fear of dosage.
Out of fear of dosage, things I would touch. It just went into, and so that part of the brain, it just finds ways to manifest. Cut to 3 years ago, I was making the second Fun album.
Yeah.
Some nights we worked with a
hip. That's a big record.
Yeah, that one did well. We worked with a hip-hop producer who was working these crazy hours, very opposite of how I grew up.
Yeah.
Long story short, the process of making the album was so hard on my body, I developed a horrible pneumonia, and I almost died.
Yeah.
I went to the ICU and ended up in the hospital for 5 days, then home on intravenous antibiotics for like 3 weeks. It was crazy.
Wow.
And since then, I'm so connected with this idea of, you know, have you ever been sick where you're really knocked out?
Yeah.
It's really terrifying, and now I'm working on it hard, but I'm in a very hypochondriacal
stage. What in place. Terms of being on top of your health, what you eat?
Insanely on top of my health. I'm on a cocktail of different supplements that I think are actually interesting and are working.
Like what?
Immunokinoco, Cold FX, Selenium D. I saw a specialist who just put me on all these different things that just boost your immune system.
Really?
Yeah.
Because I take a few things.
I believe in it.
You do?
Yeah.
Why not? That's all that matters.
If I have to take 12 pills every morning and they're not going to kill me and there's a tiny chance they'll help, I'll do it.
Right, until you get tired of it.
Yeah.
Until one day comes, you're like, I just want to see if these are doing anything.
But you know what? A doctor said something to me, which I'll say to you because I think it might make sense to you.
Okay.
Is you're going to feel this way till you're 120.
What?
You're going to die.
The pain. It's a very optimistic doctor. Well, I appreciate that.
Guys like you, I don't think die.
God, I hope you're right. Yeah, I mean, it's certainly my father just seems to be fighting the good fight. All right, so you're sort of a New Jersey kid, and before tragedy strikes, what are you doing? Because I listen to a lot of your music, a lot of it.
Really?
Yeah.
There's a lot out there.
There is, but like I knew you were coming in, and it was weird. It was one of these things where, okay, I'm going to do some research. You know, this guy, he had a hit record. He won a Grammy for a song. Which song was that?
We Are Young.
Yeah, big song.
It was a big song.
With the kids, though. I'm an old man.
Yeah.
So like, a lot of stuff you may have done, it didn't come across my desk. So, you know, then I talked to your girlfriend, and she tells me about you, and then I heard about you. So then I got to go get all the records, and I get all the records.
Mm-hmm.
Get all of them. Not this stuff from before you made records.
Yeah.
Maybe there's some bootlegs or you have that stuff.
I'll send them to you.
You will? Do you have them?
They exist.
But I got the Steel Train records and I got the Fun records.
Mm-hmm.
And I listened to the Bleachers, the two singles.
Cool.
So I'm up to speed.
Wow.
Yeah. Is that enough?
I wish everyone would do that.
Is that more? Is there more?
No. Well, I do a lot of work with other people, but that's not as...
Some songwriting and some producing?
Yeah.
But the thing that I came upon yesterday is, holy shit, this guy's sort of a genius. How did I not know about it?
Thanks, Mark.
Sure. Like, he seems to know what he's doing. He seems to be a little unclear about his identity early on. And there was a big shift that was kind of confusing to me.
Well, maybe you've had that in your career where it's like, have you had moments that you thought were supposed to be worked out alone in your bedroom that got worked out in public artistically?
Sure.
That's what a lot of that was.
Right, but because your talent is fairly focused and amazing, you know, what you were able to do developmentally, like with the first Steel Train record, was create this beautiful, strangely lyrical, almost proto-hippie album.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, then the second Steel Train record's like, what the fuck happened? You know, it's a lot different.
Yeah.
And then I'm reading up on you. It's like, oh, two dudes left. That must have been it. Those guys were holding them back. They were making them play, have mandolin and pedal steel. Like, I couldn't quite put it together. But, like, where did it start for you? I mean, what, were you always a bright kid?
No.
No?
Well, not in school.
What'd your, wait, let me try to generalize your middle-class Jewish upbringing. What'd your father do?
Business.
In the general business.
In like a broad way. But he's an amazing ragtime guitar player.
Really?
Yeah, and he studied with Reverend Gary Davis.
Really?
Yeah, and he...
So he was a young Jewish man who says, I need to learn this black man's music.
Yes.
And I'm going to seek him out.
And he went to his house and would study with him weekly.
Where? Where did he live at that time?
Bergenfield, New Jersey.
Reverend Davis?
Reverend Gary Davis lived there too, I guess.
He lived in New Jersey.
Absolutely.
So your dad kind of got strangely obsessed with this old blues man,
my
basically.
My dad was obsessed with that music, ragtime, like a very like gritty southern version of ragtime.
Right.
And he has these demos, which I should email you because they're incredible. You would never guess it was a Jewish guy going to Boston University from New Jersey.
I went to Boston University.
You did?
How old is your dad?
59.
Yeah, would have missed him.
The Howard Stern era.
Yeah, well, that was the one before me.
Yeah.
So he's a business guy, obsessed But he's like classic boomer, like that. There was a time there where that kind of music was, you know, and it was not unusual for someone to be obsessed with that music.
No. Yeah, that made sense.
Yeah. So he's an amazing guitar player?
Unbelievable. Like a specific style of finger picking that is so like skilled.
Uh-huh.
You know, just where you have the thumb constantly going.
Yeah. Like I don't know how to finger pick at all. It annoys me.
It's very like, here, I'll show you like, one sec.
It takes me, it's too much discipline.
Like this kind of stuff. Like this is a song you showed me. Like that kind of like crazy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that stuff's very impressive.
It's very impressive, and it's also very like Lindsey Buckingham, like that kind of crazy stuff.
Oh man, he can play, man.
Yeah, and to like, do it with soul is really incredible.
Do you ever think about that? That what happened to Fleetwood Mac after Lindsey Buckingham? I mean, he turned it out. I mean, that was it. It was all Lindsey Buckingham.
Yeah, he seems way more troubled than his physical appearance would suggest, because he looks like Paul Reiser.
A little bit.
And my dad.
Yeah, and your dad looks like that as well? Yeah,
it's the Paul Reiser, Richard Gere, Lindsey Buckingham sort of...
Yeah, Jew.
Yeah.
Except Lindsey Buckingham's not a Jew.
No.
I don't think so.
There's no way.
No, I don't think... Not with that name, unless it's not his real name.
Not with that kind of anger.
No. Well, no. There are definitely many angry Jews.
It's more of a self-hatred thing.
Right, we do it inward.
Yeah.
We
Are you a Jew?
Yeah.
Okay.
We manufacture our...
Is that an insane question?
Kinda. It's kind of an insane question.
Your face is way more symmetrical, and your features are taking up way less real estate on your face.
I don't know. I'm certainly sort of vocal about it to a point of where it may annoy people. But yeah, I'm a Jew. I come from New Jersey Jews, not unlike you. So you grew up with a guitar-playing father in a nice upper-middle-class household.
Yes.
And were you a troubled kid?
No.
No? You seem very well-adjusted. Your generation bothers me.
No, everything was really fine. Everything was fine. Well, my sister was always sick, so that was not fine.
Right.
But everything was... I don't really remember much.
Right.
About that point in life. Like, I was really into punk music when I was, like, 13 to 17. I had a punk band. That's all I thought about.
You had a punk band?
Yeah, and I would just play in, like, fire halls every weekend.
A working punk band?
Yeah. We did well.
And really?
Well, I mean, no, but yeah.
What was the name of the punk band?
Outline.
So it was Outline. That was your first band.
My first band was called The Fizz when I was 9.
How do you have any Fizz records?
No, but we had a song called Last Week's Lunch.
What was that about?
Which was a very, very specific thing that only grade schoolers could relate to about leaving lunch in a locker. It wasn't broad.
So you had this sort of ability for a humorous slant on songwriting early on.
It wasn't humorous at the time.
It was very real.
No, those were the issues that I was dealing with at the time.
The issues of the day.
Yeah.
Where, why's my locker smell? All right, so after Fizz, you took a few years off?
No, it was one into another.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You were in Fizz from 9 to 13 or 14?
Yeah, then we started Outline.
But Fizz was an organized band?
Yeah.
Who was in it?
Guys that I went to private Jewish school with.
Yeah?
And we just practiced every weekend.
When did you start playing guitar? What age?
I think like 8.
Okay.
Ish.
And seriously playing?
Pretty right away. It went like Stamps, Coins, Star Wars, guitar. Is all I remember from my life.
And your father must have been thrilled?
I think so.
Did he give you one of his old guitars?
Yeah, a Martin D35.
You started with a Martin D35?
How
here
cool
you go,
is that?
Kid. Here's the best guitar made.
Yeah.
Have one of these.
Exactly. Which he bought in Boston and couldn't afford. I think he went to the store and it was a little more than he thought, so he didn't have money to get home. This is such a like story that you'd only imagine happening in the 70s.
Yeah.
So he played on the street till he had enough money to take the bus back.
I wonder if he bought it at Wurlitzer Music.
I don't know.
Got to find out. So you get your Martin D35, a sweet-ass guitar, and a dad that can pick the fuck out of ragtime music.
Yeah.
Did he show you, was he your first teacher?
No, I had this guy named Van who would come to the house.
Van.
Yeah.
What was his story? What was his hair like?
It was like a bouffant. He was a Frank Sinatra impersonator, was his day job. Or I guess teaching guitar was his day job. It was his other job.
He was a Frank Sinatra impersonator?
Yeah.
And a guitar teacher.
Mm-hmm.
What was the first song you learned?
I think it was an old Aerosmith hit.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like I think I learned like the
Mama
riff
Kin or something? Sweet Emotion or something?
Yeah, one of those. Bing, I wanted to learn Dream On, but it was too hard.
Did you get it now? Can you do it now?
I could try. I hope.
You haven't tried since?
No.
You never went back?
No, I don't like learning songs.
Yeah, I don't either, but I would just sing for closure.
I feel in that, like the last thing I tried to learn was the piano part to Scenes from an Italian Restaurant, the Billy Joel song.
Great song.
I have a lot of theories about Billy Joel being great that are...
Really?
Yeah, I think
he's... Are they controversial theories?
No, because there's nothing controversial about Billy Joel, which is probably why no one thinks he's great.
Well, I don't know if that's true. He's got a temper.
Did you see the video? There's a great YouTube video of him smashing his mic.
No.
Oh, God. Just for fun, just...
He looks like an angry
Billy Joel
man
freaking
to me.
Out.
But the thing is, so you loved Billy Joel.
Well, I love Billy Joel and I love Bruce Springsteen in very different ways, but I feel like my generation has an interesting take on those two artists.
Where it's
Which
like, is what?
Springsteen's our savior.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he was... Well, you look at like the 90s, he was sort of uncool for a moment, and then this thing happened in the early 2000s where all of a sudden it was like the Arcade Fire and everyone was referencing Springsteen.
Huh.
And he kind of got back in.
After The Rising?
Yeah, I think it was around the time of The Rising.
Right.
And now he's just the most important artist living to... I think a lot of people.
To you?
One of them to me.
Why?
Because he, well, first of all, he's obviously a completely brilliant songwriter, but I think it's mostly in the light. I think he represents something that we don't get in modern music, which is this give a shit attitude.
Integrity.
Yeah, there's an integrity to it. There's an earnestness. It's such a weird apathetic time. Look, okay, I grew up in the 90s, so
yeah.
I grew up in an amazing time in music.
Like, who are your guys?
I turned on pop radio, and it was like Nirvana and Pearl Jam.
Right.
It was a happening moment.
But then also there's the whole hip-hop world that, like, I missed, but you didn't.
Yeah, that was cool, too. Like, you walked down the street when I was growing up, anyone your age you were friends with because you were a part of the same
musical
great culture.
Taste. Right.
Rap rock happens a couple years later and destroys the universe.
Yeah, who was that?
Limp Bizkit and all that shit.
Destroyed the universe.
Literally just destroyed music, and then... My experience, as I remember it, was everyone just scurried in all these different directions. And you had indie, and you had indie hip-hop, and you had mainstream music, and you had pop, and it was all so separate. And when I started touring, it was this generation of, we have to be embarrassed to be in a band. This
because
indie
it,
music
it, it
thing.
It didn't exist anymore.
I still hate it.
Touring in a band.
Everyone was still in bands, but instead of like the culture of the 90s of wanting to take over the world like Eddie Vedder in a cool way, it was like you had to pretend like you didn't give a shit.
Right.
And all these bands acted like, oh, we're so embarrassed to be here. And the songs reflected it and everything was apologetic.
Right.
So I think Springsteen represents this like excitement about music. I'm doing a fist right now as I talk about it.
Raising your fist in the air.
We all wish.
Maybe we were born to run.
Yeah, we all wish we could get to that.
Yeah, and also he had a tremendous sense of theatrics and build in his songwriting.
Totally, and then the soft, he's got everything. Mm-hmm. I'm on Fire is one of my favorite songs of all time.
Is it?
And it's one of the most simple songs of all time.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was never as a kid a Bruce fanatic.
I wasn't either. It was later on, it was when I was like, later in my 20s.
And then you listen to like Greetings from Asbury Park. It's like, what is he, Van Morrison now?
Yeah.
What's happening? All right, so you got Bruce, Jersey's Own.
Yeah.
And you got Billy Joel.
I think Billy Joel, through a series of fashion choices,
got
not even kidding,
pushed aside.
Banter. Yeah, I think, you know, because you sift through some of like the clarinets and some of the bullshit.
Yeah.
And he's one of the greatest American songwriters and performers of all time.
Right.
But he just didn't, like, I saw him in Vegas recently and he starts playing She's Got a Way About Her, beautiful song, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then he stops playing it. This is exactly what's wrong with Billy Joel. And he starts saying to the audience, this is fucking banter, okay? He starts going, you know, sometimes when I'm playing a song, I think about what I'm going to have for dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, people are like, this is one of the most beautiful songs ever. Then he launches back into the song, and in between the lyrics, he's got a way about her. He starts narrating, oh, maybe I love a cheeseburger. I don't know what it is. Maybe I love ribs later. And he's going back and forth in like this like psychotic.
That's tragic.
It was terrible. And it made me realize like this is the problem. Like he's his own worst enemy. But the songs and the records, like you put on The Stranger, it's incredible.
All the way through.
Amazing.
I remember when I got that, I must have been in seventh or eighth grade. And because I remember seeing him on Saturday Night Live. Do you know, come out, Virginia, don't let me.
It's like the leather jacket, Buffon, cocaine
phase?
No,
it was before. Like, I don't remember him being that way, but I remember there were two guitar players playing acoustic guitar next to him.
Uh-huh.
And he sat in between them, in my recollection of it. And I'm like, what is this guy? I had no idea who he was. And I bought that record, and I played the shit out of it. And, you know, I could probably still sing all of those songs. But I think that your appreciation for songwriting, you know, is something... I don't know if it's unique. I know people write their own music, but you really understand and appreciate the craft of popular music. It's part of your thing, right?
Yeah, I love popular music.
Yeah.
I always have.
And you're unashamed of that now.
I want to be unashamed of that.
But you're still a little ashamed of it?
I think until popular music really kind of gets back to, you know, a lot of the popular music we have today yeah. was the novelty stuff that was 1% in the 90s. It's like Macarena or whatever, like mm-hmm. Salt and Pepper, like those bands were like this like tiny percentage of the radio in between the good stuff that was like this weird novelty thing.
Yeah.
And now it's kind of flipped. So, I you know, in my head,
yeah.
I want to be the person to change that, but that's a hard thing to say out loud.
Yeah. No, it's not. It's a goal.
There's yeah. yeah. You know, I want to give a shit.
Well, I mean,
I don't want to be like stuck in my own little world and think that that was a big thing when Fun got big is like, how do you accept a place where people are listening?
Right.
And not do this humble thing that's so humble that you're just kind of like shooting yourself in the foot and missing an opportunity to do something cool.
Well, I think that's a noble thing. It's like to sort of work against cool and to work against it's basically it's like a comic playing to the back of the room.
Kind of.
You know what I mean? Like, who do you want to impress? Your shitty friends who are bitter anyways?
I want to move on from
and
that.
And defeated
yeah.
in a way and sort of justifying their defeat ideologically by acting like they don't give a shit when they're really just angry and can't do better?
It's hard to let go of that, though, because you start, like I'm sure in your work, too, you start only impressing those people because those are the only people who are watching.
And you're also sort of a weird community as well. Like
yeah.
they're supporting you. They want you to be out of the box. They want you to be unique. They want you to represent what they want to represent, which is, you know, a cultural ideal mm-hmm. within that culture. But then all of a sudden, if you want to go after the grail and do something like change popular music by honoring its format, it's tricky.
It's very tricky.
You're going to have to cut some of those people loose. But you know what? They'll be back around when they're 40.
I hope.
Yeah, this is like, these are really 20 to 35 year old problems.
Okay, good.
Because if you pull off what you want to do and you continue to evolve as an artist, at some point, you're just not going to give a fuck about those people genuinely.
Yeah.
You're going to be so happy with your own creativity that you're going to be like, nah, fuck them. And you're not even going to think about it anymore. And then they'll start coming around going like, you know, I didn't respect what you're doing a few years ago, but like, it's really good.
Okay, cool.
And you win.
Waiting for it.
You win. And the guys that still hold on to whatever you're afraid of, they're going to be stuck in that shit. They're going to be 40 years old saying, they sold out.
You got people in your life like that?
I don't know. I don't talk to them much.
They're gone.
They did go away.
That's good.
Because one thing I learned about and it was fairly recently, and thinking about it in retrospect, is that people are going to project their own shit onto you.
Yeah.
It's not a reflection of you. They've made you into something.
Totally.
You know, and you represent something to them. So if you don't honor what they want you to do, it's sort of their problem. So until you can realize that, it's like, well, I got to do this other thing. I'm sorry, but I don't really know you. I'm glad you liked that one record you liked. But, you know, you're projecting your expectations onto me because of your problems.
So. Yeah, people get grossed out by ambition sometimes.
Well, you got to hide it.
You do.
I don't know that. I never had it financially, but I think I innately have ambition to keep going. But I think it's if you're ambitious and you're successful, that's a toxic mixture to some people that are just bitter.
Yes.
You know? Because then you're like, you don't even have a name anymore. You're fuck that guy. That's your name. Fuck that guy. Right?
You're fucking dead on.
That's all right. So it seems to me that you've got enough people in the world that you aren't fuck that guy to.
I hope.
Well, let's go back to the punk band. So when you were in your punk band in junior high after Fizz, what were you doing? Original songs, all original
yeah.
songs.
We did a couple Gorilla Biscuits and Minor Threat covers, but it was mostly original. I was always really into original music. Like, back to what I was saying before, I hated learning songs. It always made me feel inadequate because I could never get it right. I don't read music.
Right.
I don't want to read music. Like,
right.
I was always so excited about just the shit you just figure out.
Right. And but you, I don't having don't, no idea what those punk songs are. Were they as melodic? Were they as orchestrated as some of your later music? Was it just, you know, three chord garbage, or was it, you know, were you consciously writing songs that had a pop element to them?
No, it was very worked out. It was very pop in the way they were put together.
So it wasn't like, it wasn't angry punk. It was more, who was the first real pop punkers? You know, like there was a time where those minor chords started showing up, and there was, I know Green Day sort of became that, but it was
before
that.
Well, like in Jersey, it was Lifetime.
Uh-huh.
Remember Lifetime?
Mm-mm.
They were like, at the time, people were calling it emo, which became a very bad word, but mm-hmm. Lifetime was like this like post-hardcore, like it was like a melodic Minor Threat thing.
Okay.
When I was first growing up, that was a really cool word.
Right.
That's when I first heard it. and Lifetime Kid Dynamite. That was a Philly band. This like it all came from hardcore, and that's what Outline was like. But what was cool about that time period was the sound sucked so bad at all the shows,
right,
that I really learned how to play live.
Right.
So you had to put on such a good live show that it didn't matter that there was like no PA and no.
Right.
So it was all about, which is a feeling I have this day when I walk on stage, is like, I got to fucking blow this thing over the top. This has to be, which is very connected. It's like, it's a Springsteen / growing up playing in Legion Hall's feeling of like,
yeah,
leave it all on the stage.
Right. Because you had to fight it out for real.
Yeah.
And you had to figure out how to make, you know, the sound or your tone or whatever you were trying to do. Because I know you also have a tremendous appreciation for production, so I got to assume that, you know, just being loud is not the issue. It's how do you be loud and sort of contain and keep your tone.
We always talk about this idea of big strokes.
Uh-huh.
The sound guy I work with always talks about that. Like, how do you paint with big strokes live? How do you make these choices be massive? Like, if you take a guitar solo, how is everyone hearing that? If there's drums are smashing the toms, how is that, you know, like,
got to slow it down a little.
Big strokes. Yeah. I did learn that.
You got to make sure it gets to the back of the room before it echoes back at everybody and becomes a mess.
That's what I've learned playing in bigger venues.
Right?
The bigger, more brooding
uh-huh.
stuff that might seem slightly boring in the studio sometimes is more exciting live.
Yeah, because it takes a while to get it back there.
It does. It really
yeah.
does.
And then it'll bounce back at you. So if it's almost like with comedy, it's a timing thing.
Mm-hmm.
In order for it to roll back all the way, you can't jump on it because it'll fucking eat itself.
That's why I hate comedy in big venues.
No, I don't either. I don't like it either.
It's a disaster.
It is a disaster because you can't work at the pace you want to work at.
Yeah.
But you can't really accommodate songs that you can't slow it down.
I've done that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we'll slow stuff down live. Or you strip out production. Like, to me, it's all in the drums. You know, people have to be able to like feel like if there's just too much going on in the kick pattern or there's too much nuance, sometimes you just, in a big venue, you just pull it back.
So, all right, so you're playing in this punk band, but you're writing pop songs. You're aware of your songwriting skills and you are doing orchestrations of things. You're not just blasting out for the sake of getting your rocks off. You're a songwriter and you're a musician and you take it seriously.
Yeah, I was very serious about it.
So how do you get from there to Steel Train? What happens?
I went to public high school in New Jersey. And everyone tortured me for being gay. I'm not gay.
Yeah.
Because that was the generation of if you had blue hair, you were gay.
Right.
I really didn't like it.
Well, you're sort of an adorable little man.
Thank
so
you.
You're going to get
Thank
a little
Mark.
Of that.
And I never thought I was gay. I just, it actually, at that time in history, the word gay had nothing to do with homosexuality.
Which right.
This is recent history. You know,
right.
It was just
sure.
like,
you're just gay.
You suck, you're
yeah,
gay.
Yeah.
And so I left that school and I went to this place called the Professional Children's School because my sister was going there in Manhattan, which was a school started for ballerinas.
I just talked to somebody who went there. Yeah, it's not the one from Fame. It's another
one. It's the other one.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't actually learn art. You can just leave if you want to do art.
Okay.
So I was starting to tour a little bit. And I went from going to this place where everything was gay as in not cool to a place where I was one of two straight kids in the entire school.
Right.
Where everything literally was gay.
Right.
Which was a wonderful experience. It was like... fucking when they whatever that story is when they leave the desert and they're in the fucking good shit or
right,
you know
right.
what I'm talking about
the like, Jews
yeah
and they go for the 40 days and it rains bread and then they get to the good place
yeah they get to the good place it was
okay.
like that moment
yeah
not clear on that story
me neither clearly neither one of us are that religious
so I found this wonderful place
and that was all arts
all
yeah music people there yeah dance people there
yeah
actors
dance,
there
actors.
Was there visual arts as well
yeah there was a good friend of mine was a painter there was a chess player there was an equestrian
chess
was just,
is an art
it's something that you need to leave school for if you're a professional at that age
oh okay so it's a professional school it's not
yeah.
necessarily an art school
it was more arts but it was
so it was really catering to kids who were kind of working
yeah
or doing what they set out to do
and I wanted to tour
with
Outline
mm-hmm. the punk band
yeah so then we did our first tour which we borrowed my parents' minivan. I booked a tour from New Jersey to all the way down to Florida, over to Texas and back.
And you had juice? I mean, you had enough juice to pull people?
No. Back then, this is pre-internet, really. There was this thing called Book Your Own Fucking Life. Did you ever hear of this?
No.
It was a book that
yeah.
got passed around like punk scenes.
Right.
And it had the phone numbers of everyone you needed to know.
Oh, interesting.
So I sat there with Book Your Own Fucking Life and I called all these people. We made $300 in a whole 3-week tour. but it was the best experience of my life, and I fell in love with touring.
Were you opening for people, or
no? We were playing like pizza shops. We played an anarchist bookshop called the Stone Soup Collective.
Were you pulling
Florida.
Crowds at all?
No, it was just like whoever was there.
And that made you fall in love with it?
I loved it.
You were like, this is the greatest thing ever.
Because I fell in love with touring before I fell in love with playing shows on tour.
Because of the unity, of the discipline of it, of the sort of like moving from place to place.
It's the coolest thing ever. It's like, it's a road trip.
And how many people are in this band? Who's in the band with you?
There are five people in the band.
And who are they?
They're one of the guys is still one of my best friends, and he played in Steel Train for 10 years.
Uh-huh.
And then everyone else, we've lost touch.
Okay. So, yeah. But
well, not lost touch. Eddie, the singer, we're still close.
Yeah.
But everyone else is kind of.
Did they get out of the music business?
Most of them.
Uh-huh. All right, so you do this tour, and then you get back to New Jersey, and you're all juiced up.
All juiced up.
You know your life now.
I met this guy, Scott, in high school. We started playing songs together, and that was, we started Steel Train.
So, okay, so, but still, how do you get from punk rock? Where, see, this is the thing for me. How do you get from punk rock to really doing, you know, I guess it was popular at the time, right? Fleet Foxes and some other, like,
it
whatever.
It was before that.
It was before that.
Yeah. So it was Beck Sea Change came out when I started Steel Train.
Okay, so there was this reverence for the Flying Burrito Brothers, for Nick Drake.
Well, Beatles have always been my greatest inspiration.
The Beatles.
100%.
But I don't hear a lot of Beatles on that first Steel Train record. Am I missing it?
No, there's not a lot there, but it's just always been that idea of kind of everyone playing in the room together, that kind of orchestration.
Oh, okay, fine.
I never got too specific with the influence, but just more what they were about.
But there was a specific influence. I mean, was it just because of that producer? I mean, the songs you were writing were...
It was drugs.
But
into pot and mushrooms and stuff like that.
But you must have been listening to that music, because there was there is definitely a hippie music idea.
Because
in
that, we started listening to like the Dead.
So there's a lot of Dead
and
there.
Folksy stuff.
Okay.
It was like a very concentrated moment that wasn't me.
What? But it was you.
It really wasn't. I was in this weird post-traumatic stress haze. I was very like...
But that music that you were listening to and doing those drugs must have been comforting. I mean, the record is a fully realized, beautiful record. So whether it was you or not, you applied your talent to something that was making you feel better.
I was in a disassociative place. And I was outside of my body. And I think that was something that was making me feel good. So I went with that. But it wasn't like...
But did you feel connected to that community?
No.
Was the idea, was like, you know, I can just, you know, open up and lay back, like, was there a spiritual sort of notion behind it?
No, we just kind of got into it as a group.
It's interesting.
It was like a group thing, and then very quickly we got out of it.
You sat down and you listened to, what, American Beauty and Working Man's Dead?
Yeah, and we called the producer, Stephen Barnhart, who made American Beauty, and we asked him to work with us.
That was a whim? Like, maybe we could...
Yeah, I remember where we were in Anaheim, and me and Evan, the bass player...
You were on tour?
Yeah.
With
Steel Train at that time. We took this demo we made and we brought it to a FedEx and sent it to Steven.
Yeah. And he said...
Like cold.
Yeah. And he was like, I'm not doing anything.
And he was like, come up to Northern California. Let's do this thing.
We'll get Grisman out here.
Literally. That was basically the conversation. And we were like, cool.
And you got that pedal steel guy?
Gene Parsons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's insane.
He'll play with the birds. Yeah, it was very cool. And it was the first time I felt like vaguely successful, because I was playing with people who were technically successful.
Right.
But it was, God, if I knew back then at the time, like how early on in the you know, the process that was going to be of touring and making records, I probably would have just like jumped off a bridge.
But it's weird. So you feel the need to sort of, contextualize that record, because it seems so out of character for you.
It's important for me to understand where it came from. Well, it's also, everything is very tied in. Like there's a song in there called Grace where the theme of the song is the movement of a funeral. Like it's very, all these things are so closely connected to my experiences
with your sister.
Yeah, that like it's very important for me to intellectualize it and understand where it was coming from and why at that time I felt the need to say the things and make it that way.
Did you feel like you got any emotional closure?
Not from then. That was a terrible time.
Really?
Horrible.
So the record didn't help.
No, the record was I don't know. It was just a very bad time.
How old were you?
I was 19, 20.
Oh, so this is like a year after it happened.
Right then.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
So that kind of just...
I got my first record deal 2 months before she died. It was a very weird time in life. Everything was possible and everything was impossible. It was really strange.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
So, okay, so you do that record, and what happens? Do you have a breakdown of some kind after?
I didn't have a breakdown until about a year later.
So the record does well?
No.
Doesn't.
I mean, it kept us on the road. My experience, until Fun Made Some Nights, it was just always...
Working.
The perfect way to put it is our accommodations. We started sleeping in the van, at rest stops when I was on tour with Outline. Then we would ask people if we could stay at their house, and then we would get one room at a Comfort Inn. Then we get two rooms at a Comfort Inn. Then we got two rooms at the Hampton Inn. Then eventually two rooms at the Sheraton. And then, like, it was always moving very, very slowly.
Right.
So I was never, even though the universe was giving me some information that it wasn't really working out, it wasn't specifically not working out.
Right. Because so you were opening act in Steel?
Yeah, opening mostly? Act, or we would headline and play to 100 people here and 10 people there.
Who were you opening for?
We went out with Rich Robinson once from the Black Crows. We went out with Grace Potter. Steel Train towards the end started doing really well when we did tours with like Tegan and Sarah and started doing all the festivals. But Steel Train changed so many times. I mean, that's a band that should have changed names three times.
So when did you hit the wall?
About a year after that album came out, I started freaking out and getting real panic attacks.
Yeah. Which couldn't breathe.
I'm sure you've had them.
You seem might like be having one now.
The type.
Can't breathe.
Things just, I mean, just physically, I thought I was dying, having a heart attack.
Numb.
Completely numb.
Really? You get numb?
I get
hands
numb
and feet?
Hands, spinny, can't breathe, just break into like an immediate like
sweat.
Pouring sweat. And the worst thing is the emotional thing where I just don't know what's going on.
The fucking thing is that like, because you were not processing the grief.
No. That's a fascinating thing about my life looking back on it and just about the human body is like it'll fucking come out of your body. If you
somehow
don't deal with it in your mind,
somehow
your body will release it.
It's the worst because
it's amazing.
And what happens is, because I'm sort of in it right now, I am not clear why, because I've just been through a couple of difficult relationships, you know, but like, you know, you're doing your day, you're functioning.
Yeah.
But like all of a sudden you're just like, you're like,
you can't escape it.
Well, yeah, there's almost like something is pressing out of your face.
Literally.
Really?
There's like energy coming off
right,
of your body.
And you're like, what wants out of me? What wants out?
And there's no triggers. It just happens.
No, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And you become, were you raging out?
I was terrified.
Ugh.
And then, as you know, when you go through this stuff, the first time it happens, then the fear grows into not just what it is, but when's it going to happen? And that's when it gets really bad.
But the problem is if you don't believe that it's stress, and like still, I'm not quite convinced yet. I still have to go to a couple doctors.
Okay.
But is that the physical symptoms start to, you become focused on those. So it almost feeds itself. Like you're not dealing with the emotional stuff underneath.
Yeah, you're dealing with, am I going to have a panic attack?
Yeah. Or,
not,
or
why am
like,
I having panic attack?
Why is my, am, do like, why am I, do I have MS? What's happening?
Exactly. I got obsessed with the senses, going blind. I would go have my vision checked all the time, going deaf. I was obsessed with my heartbeat and feeling
it.
Did
you hear your heartbeat in your ears and shit?
I've had that a lot.
God damn it.
And I would just get these like rings that would come and go.
Yes.
The body is
chest
like
pains.
Terrible chest pains. I had so many, what's it called when they hook all the things up to you? Is that a cardiogram?
EKGs?
Yeah, EKGs.
Yeah, cardiogram, I guess.
It got
to
the point where a lot of my doctors I would go in, they would just be like, you're fine. Yeah. I believe in medication. that's actually something that really helped me. If you're having a panic attack, you know, I think you should fucking take a Xanax.
Yeah.
Because I think you have to break the cycle.
So how, like, but like when you went through that, the psychedelic period and the weed period, you know, the one thing that struck me was that, you know, the music sounded so great and you're so clearly talented and so clearly, you know, like the fact that you trying to find your voice musically or whatever the hell was going on was so well articulated. It was very hopeful, obviously. But when, how much drugs were you doing?
I mean, we were smoking pot all the time. We were smoking hash a lot.
So, but you weren't fucking bottoming out.
No,
on
I wasn't on like heroin or coke. I was just.
Or drinking.
No, I drank a bunch. I was just in a place. I'm very sensitive to anything like that.
Right.
Like if I just very, very sensitive. Like if I took a Tylenol right now, I'd have a feeling. So I was just in a different place.
All right. So what ultimately happens? How do you level off?
I had the terrible experience of the acid.
Okay,
which
that
is
was
referenced
it.
In that Bleacher song when I say panicked at the acid test.
Panic at the acid test.
and then that changed everything, but I still don't really drink.
Yeah.
Kind of all because of that experience, the idea of being outside of my body at all just shifted. I thought I died. We were in a car and we were going to Portland. We were on tour and I was like, all of a sudden I was like, we died.
Yeah.
And I was obsessed with it and I was like, we died.
Yeah.
We had a car accident. This is like a different version of reality.
Oh my God, you locked into that?
And then I went home and I was fine.
Yeah.
And then the next day I woke up and I felt like I was tripping again. So I ran.
You still living with your parents?
Yeah. I moved to my parents like 2 years ago. Yeah, Fun had number one album in the country when I moved out of my parents' house. Sorry, before I moved out of my parents' house.
And they were fine with it because there's this panic in, at the core of your family
life
now.
Just, yeah, thrilled to have me around.
Yeah, yeah. So I, we know where he is.
I've been very compelled to do a lot of things in my life. I was so uncompelled to leave home.
Yeah.
I just could give a shit. And I moved out because I got in a relationship and wanted to.
Yeah.
But I was there for a while.
How old are you, 30?
Yeah.
So you're there till you're 28. And you didn't have to be there. You could have left.
Which is funny because before you're quote unquote successful in a commercial way, all the neighbors think, oh, he's in a van smoking pot playing shows. He's a loser.
Right, right.
And then when I was in a band that people saw, thought was a big band and whatnot, they were like, oh, he's mentally ill. So he's just, you can't win with the neighbors.
But ultimately, I think that not unlike the effect it had on your personal life and also your own creativity, it seems like the death of your sister really, your family needed to be close. So
yeah.
Like, there was that.
It worked. It
probably never seemed that unusual to be at home still.
No, I don't think. I think I would have been more stressed out leaving home and wondering what was happening there.
Yeah. So now, what album do you finally pull it together? I mean, because Steel Train got big. You did, what, two Bonnaroos? You did a live at Bonnaroo thing?
Yeah, we did a lot of cool. We never really hit our stride, but we did a lot of cool stuff. Like, we played on Letterman and
Conan,
and we did all the cool festivals. And
but that was after you came through the woods? After,
yeah.
Like, what album did the acid thing happen?
Was on that first album.
All this happened after the first album.
And then 2007, we made an album called Trampoline, which I think was the first thing I've done that was interesting.
It was completely a different sound. Like, you
totally.
Know, right out of the gate, there's less acoustic noodling. You're no longer laid back drumming. There's all of a sudden it's like Queen. You know, there's like
there's a
bigness to it right away.
Yeah,
like the production is like up front.
Well, it starts with a song. The first song on that album is called "I Feel Weird," which was about having panic attacks.
Uh huh.
And it was very literal.
So it was all very autobiographical. Is all your songwriting autobiographical?
I mean, I Want to Get Better, which is the Bleacher single, is about all these stories I'm telling you. It's just from the lens of now. I don't know how to write about anything else, and I kind of don't even want to. I feel like the only thing that makes me remotely interesting is just what I've been through and my take on it.
Well, that's how you and I are similar.
I like to write the way I speak.
But did you write a hit song for Taylor Swift? Was it a hit?
Yeah, I've written a bunch of stuff. I did. That's with other people, it's different though, because then you're in the room, you're talking. I don't really write lyrics for other people. Like, I work on the music and melodies and stuff. Like,
oh, really?
Yeah. Like, when I work with Taylor, I did a bunch of stuff on, I did Brave for Sarah Bareilles.
Mm-hmm. How do you get gigs like that? How does that happen? Do they respect you? They like your music? Are you known by the label as like, this guy can make hits? I mean, what world is that now?
Now it's a little bit of that. Now it's a little bit like people will call me because they're like, oh, this guy can
punch it up.
Can make it happen. But at the beginning, when Fun started getting big in a commercial way, I always wanted to work with other artists, but I never had the opportunity. Then it was like, oh, you can do this if you want.
Mm-hmm.
And I started, the first thing I did was a song with Tegan and Sarah on their album.
Yeah.
And then I ended up working with Sarah and Taylor, and just kind of gone off into working with a lot of different women.
So women like you?
I like working with women.
Yeah?
I don't think I've never done anything good with a man.
Why?
I don't know. I think from a songwriting perspective, like I always write a song in falsetto and then I drop it a full step down. Like, I hear things like the way women sing. I hear things in women's voices.
Right.
I like women's voices better than men's voices.
Right.
I think they're more interesting.
Yeah.
There's a wider spectrum of sounds that come out of women.
Uh huh.
I just like it better. I like talk. I don't, men are disgusting.
Yeah.
For the most part, you know? Especially men in music. I think women in music are more interesting. Like, I think men in music.
What do you mean they're disgusting?
I think men are more often disgusting than women. Women are disgusting too.
In what way?
They're just more often. Here's a better way to put it. I'm more likely to be in a situation where a man thinks I'm a certain way that I'm not, and then the situation is uncomfortable.
So
than
you
I am
feel
with the
judged
woman.
By men.
Like, I've been in situations with men where they're like, oh, I fucked this chick last night, and I'm just like, I'm not having this conversation. You know, like, not that I'm not interested. You know, I'll watch hours of porn on my own, but like,
I don't want to talk about it.
But yeah, like, do you want to talk about that? Like, if I came in here and started talking about it, there'd be nothing to say.
It's an awkward conversation. And I think that, it's almost a, it's almost stereotypical, and I don't know that it happens as often as I think after a certain age, because, you know, it's a certain type of dude that does that.
Yeah, but they're in music.
Well, yeah, they're around, like, dude, last night, you see that one?
Yeah, they're even... And they're,
tagged their...
Yeah, they do interesting work. Yeah, like, close the deal.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just... that doesn't happen... There's a better chance that if I'm in the room working with a woman, that we're going to get along.
And she's not going to say, like, this dude fucking gave it to me last night. Like, you wouldn't believe.
Or, like, I just piled through, you know, these four guys over the weekend.
You're not going to have that conversation with Taylor Swift?
No.
Okay.
I like women, and particularly gay women.
Yeah.
So, like,
you know. Yeah. Is she gay?
No, I work a lot with Tegan and Sarah.
Okay. So I was like, well, but do we have a breaking story here? Did you just tip it? No, well, that's nice. So, all right, so you ride it out with Steel Train for three records. When you stop Steel Train, when you stop the Steel Train, did you disappoint a good many people, or was there that risk? I mean, what made you choose to end that?
I didn't choose to end it. So Steel Train, so we did Trampoline.
Mm-hmm.
We did then our last record, which was self-titled. And then Fun started, me and Nate and Andrew started Fun.
What was the idea there? Was it a concept band? Because, I mean, it seemed like you were moving towards Fun with Steel Train. I mean, you know, there was that largeness there. There was the hookiness to it. The production was not as, I don't even know how to describe it because I'm not a music guy.
Grandiose?
It's big, but I don't even know if that does it. I get, it's almost theatrical.
Yeah, it's very theatrical.
Yeah, with Fun.
Yeah.
But you were sort of moving towards that.
Totally.
And what was the decision once you, to do Fun? What was the vision?
Nate, Andrew, and I met on tour in 2004,
mm-hmm.
back in the days of five bands on tour all together, and we all had our own bands. And people started sort of dropping like flies, getting other jobs, starting families, and we were always kind of always around. Even Steel Train had some revolving members.
Uh-huh.
Nate had a band called The Format. That band broke up. He called Andrew and I the day they broke up and said, I want to start a band. And I said, great. So the two of them flew out to my parents' house in New Jersey the mm-hmm. next day, and we all lived there for...
At your parents' house?
For 4 months.
And
we wrote and recorded a lot of our first album there. So Steel Train and Fun were coexisting. I was in both bands for 2 years.
Uh-huh.
And then John Schiffman, who's now in the live band of Bleachers, he quit Steel Train because I think he wanted to become a paramedic, because we were on tour, actually.
But he's in Bleachers.
He's in Bleachers. He's had a long journey. Steel Train was on tour. I was not there that day. The 2 days I left tour with Steel Train to like fly somewhere, horrible things have happened. One time they were in a van accident on top of a mountain, and then this other day a truck had flipped over and there was like a guy dying on the side of the road, and this guy, John, the drummer, jumped out and helped this guy, and in that moment realized, he was like, I want to become a fucking paramedic. So he quits the band and he says, I'm going to become a paramedic. And Fun was starting to take off, and it just felt like this is the moment. Like, I think, you know, this has kind of had its day. And I had sort of been fantasizing and even toying with the word Bleachers in my head of doing something else, because there's so much baggage that comes with a decade of music.
Yeah.
Just so much baggage.
With the emotional baggage with the guys, expectations with the music.
Yeah, you just can't really... I just really started to fantasize about just doing something else. And so the band kind of dissolved. Fun ended up, then Fun had this crazy moment, which mm-hmm. no one really expected was going to happen.
On the second record.
Yeah, we put out our second record right after Steel Train broke up.
So the incentive for Fun was really, you were burnt out from touring, from the emotional strain of being in a band, from whatever it is that burns bands out after a decade.
Mm-hmm.
But musically, what hadn't you done that you really, that these other guys... What was some of the talks about? Like, you know, I want to write bigger pop songs.
Fun?
Yeah.
The conversations were just, I'd never really, I always wrote, Steel Train was just me writing.
Yeah.
And then the band was the band, but I wrote everything. Fun was the first time I collaborated.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a totally new experience. You had three guys, me, Nate, and Andrew. We all, you know, Andrew wrote a musical. Nate wrote all the music in his band. I wrote the music in my band.
What was Nate's band like?
Called The Format. It was a lot like Baby Fun, kind of.
Uh-huh.
Like a lot of sort of Nilsson theatrical stuff going uh-huh. on.
So you get a guy that actually wrote musicals.
Yeah. All of us were the alpha writers in our own situations, and we kind of had this idea of, like, you know, 1 + 1 + 1 = 1,000.
Right.
Maybe.
Because when I listened to, right when I put on, I think it was Some Nights, like right away I'm like, this is Queen.
Yeah, we really went for it in that first song.
Right?
Yeah, we went full Queen on that. I mean, just in very literal ways, like the way they stacked harmonies.
But that's like, that's a very specific production. It didn't feel like a ripoff to me. It felt like some sort of homage to a type of production that was very specific.
Yeah, well, I mean, we love guitar solos. We love harmonies. We love string and horn arrangements. We love orchestral percussion. Like these things, Queen's one of the only rock bands that really indulge in a lot of that. So that's why the similarities.
And also wrote pop, pop songs, yeah.
And kind of rocked at the same time.
Like, right, right. And that's
what. Love all of it.
And that's where, and so that's where you get your huge success.
Yeah, maybe.
But I mean, that song is the thing that sort of set in stone your ability to write a pop song, your ability to stand out. And also, yeah, I mean, winning a Grammy is not nothing.
It's not nothing. It's a weird thing because it's like you always think of awards in your natural reaction. You always want to be like, oh, fuck that.
Right.
But it is cool. It is.
Well, that's part of you playing to the back of the room.
It is.
I mean, like, yeah, you can talk all you want about, like, they don't mean anything. Yeah, but I got one.
Yeah.
They may not mean anything, but I like to look at the one I have.
I'm happy for my grandma.
Yeah.
Because that's like, you know, like winning Grammys is something that, like, she'll always have that
and
for
me.
And
she's still around?
Yeah.
Sweet.
Yeah, and she's pumped because she was, I mean, she had to live through the whole, like, what the fuck are you doing phase.
Uh-huh. So with 10 years?
Yeah, with 10 years of, like, it's getting better, like, you know.
Well, how'd your parents react to it in general?
They always were so on the inside that I think they were just drinking the Kool-Aid with me.
Oh, they were?
Yeah, they were just, like, part of the
you
delusion.
You sold them. Well, no, I don't know if that's true, because most of the time, parents are just worried about whether or not you're going to earn a living. They're concerned for you.
Yeah.
And I think that at some point, given that your father was a musician, your talent must have been undeniable.
I think they were always, I've got them to admit once. I did this one show very early on at the Knitting Factory, and it's the only time that I've ever heard my parents really say something horrible where my dad has said to me since, he was like, that was the only time I was ever thought to myself, like, maybe you shouldn't do this.
What happened?
We were bad. We were very bad.
Really bad, huh?
But I also think losing my sister and all that just kind of like really turned the whole like, got to make a, like, you know, my parents come from parents of depression mentality.
Sure.
You know, like, you make a living, that is the goal of your fucking life. That is it, you know? And then they're an interesting generation. And then I think when we lost our sister and all that, it just, I think everyone stopped giving a shit about everything, kind of.
Right.
You know?
Because you realize how fragile it all is.
Yeah, my
and
dad
unfair,
would give me.
Unfair.
And it's also, obviously, it's the worst thing ever, but learning very specifically how unimportant money is.
Yeah.
And no matter how, you know, my dad had money and he paid for every possible, my parents' treatment that you could.
Right. Didn't matter.
Money can't buy it. So I don't think they gave a shit and I didn't give a shit. And my parents would give me $300 a week when I wasn't making money. And that's what I would live on.
Right. Some premium was put on, you know, living life to its fullest.
And I didn't care. Money and success were never connected to me.
Yeah, and me neither.
I just never gave a shit.
I think that's one of the privileges of growing up in an environment like that.
Yeah.
That, you know, when you have supportive parents, you know, one way or the other, who have money, you know, you have to be taught the importance of money in that way. And if that's not part of it, the value system necessarily, you know, you're sort of left to wander. And I think it's contemptible from other people's point of
totally.
View.
Totally.
You know, that like you're entitled, you're spoiled, you're this, you're that. But it also provided us an amazing freedom to roll the dice. The thing is that when you do succeed and you come from that background, there's always going to be haters if you have any problems at all.
Yeah.
You know, but you know, when you don't succeed, then you're just another idiot that squandered their fucking life. You know what I mean? That just sabotaged their own opportunities. Like, what the fuck is the matter with you? You could have done whatever you wanted.
Yeah.
And now look at you. You know, but then if you do make it, it's like, nah, it was easy.
Yeah, you suck. Yeah.
It was an easy ride for you, wasn't it?
People love to yell about that.
But the fucked up thing is like, no matter what, like, you know, you're going to get shots, all right? Even if your shot is a gift of some kind, even if you get a shot because you're connected or whatever the fuck it is.
If you suck, you still suck.
Right.
Yeah.
You're not going to stay up there.
Totally. That's what always fascinates me about people thinking, like, that you know, advantages are amazing, but, like, a 15-year career or, like, there's not too many accidents. You kind of have to still fucking...
Right.
You have to be
good.
You
have to show up for work and you have to deliver.
Yeah, you have to be great.
You know, no one's going to be like, no one's going to carry you for, what, a decade?
No.
You know, and I mean, people know that you're with Lena. I mean, she deals with that shit all the time.
I think it's so funny because it's like, I'd say the same thing in my head. Everyone's like, oh, all these people on the show, like, have, you know, successful parents in arts. It's like, every successful person in art, which is millions of people who have kids, aren't on TV shows.
Yeah, because, I mean,
because like no one, if someone called me and was like, if like, you know, if Phil Donahue called me and was like, hey, like my son wants to be in a band, I'd be like, go fuck yourself, Phil. Like it's irrelevant.
It is.
The quality of the work is the quality of the work. And I think it's, I just think that people love to, I've done it myself, regardless of any opportunities I've had. Sometimes I remember when the Strokes came out and I just hated them.
Yeah.
And I love the Strokes more than anything now.
Right.
Because I was so jealous when they came out because like I looked like them and I just wished that I was in the coolest thing in New York
right.
at the time.
Well, that's what
and
it really comes
like,
down to.
I remember like being in conversations where I'd be like, oh, that guy's fucking dad is like a modeling agency billionaire.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, well, that's not the reason why Julian is one of the greatest songwriters of my time.
It takes a grown-up mind to realize that. You have to get past your own jealousy.
Yeah.
It's really that simple. Fuck
him. Lena and I talk about that a lot because it's something that's inflicted on the young. Like, no one on earth when Judi Dench wins an Oscar is like, oh, that piece of shit. Like,
she had it easy.
Yeah. Or like, you know, when Helen Mirren, like, it's when you're young, all these young people, I feel it, and I've done it myself, you know. When I was a certain age, I would look at everyone my age, you know, doing music and being successful, and I would just talk about how much they suck.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wouldn't have obnoxious feelings about Nick Cave.
Right.
People my age.
Right, exactly.
And I think
it's just
you
jealousy.
See a lot of that. You
it's
know,
just jealousy.
It's interesting though. Everyone, there's a lot, we live in a culture where people do want to see people crash and burn.
Well, yeah, it's weirdly predatory.
Until they're like oddly proven and then all of a sudden you're untouchable.
Right. But then, there's still people out there, but they kind of fall away. And and as you become more confident and more respected or successful, you know, the people that are knocking at you, it's very easy to see where they're coming from.
Totally. But yeah. It is, Twitter makes it hard.
I know.
Because it's just said to your face.
I know. It's
immediately.
I have problems with that. I mean, you know, get me on a bad day and I'll engage
I
with somebody like, with six followers.
I do it too. Someone this morning, I follow Walgreens on Twitter.
Yeah.
Because I was at a gay pride parade once. I saw Walgreens float and I thought it was cool. So mm-hmm. I followed them.
Yeah.
I've not been this angry in a long time. This morning I got a tweet that someone was like, Jack Antonoff follows Walgreens, like, nice job with the corporate payout, you piece of crap. Hashtag unfollow. And it made me irate.
Yeah.
I wanted to like find this person, strangle them to death, and then yell mm-hmm. at their body
right.
that I'm not being right. paid by Walgreens.
Can a guy like Walgreens?
Yeah.
That's what you get pissed off. I'm no sellout for Walgreens. Out of all the things you're going to sell out for, it's like, yeah, I'm on the dole from Walgreens. Ridiculous. All right, so Fun has this great big record, and you what immediately decided you need to do a solo project. What's that about?
I don't know. it's funny. I wonder how. Like, I always get afraid. My biggest fear with Bleacher is that it's going to look reactionary. But then
reactionary towards yourself.
Well, I hope people. This is the dialogue in my head, which maybe no one would ever say this. My fear is that people are going to be like, oh, this guy's apologizing for being in a big band by doing something else. But then I would hope they hear it and be like, oh, it's not him hunched over as a guitar apologizing. It's just as grandiose as everything. I was wrong. That's what I would hope people would think.
Right.
But that was a fear of mine. I made the album because I wanted to make the album and I felt compelled to do it. And that's, you never know when you're going to want to work. Songwriting is absolutely bizarre. And so I force myself to sit down every day and work. But, you know, I can work for 3 weeks on something and then be on a run and then sing an idea into my phone, which makes everything the past 3 weeks irrelevant.
Nothing. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And for some reason, I was never able to write on tour before. I don't know what happened the past 2 years when I was working on the Bleachers album. Truly unideal time to make work. Ideas started coming and I started recording. For example, like I Want to Get Better, I did the vocals in my hotel room in Malaysia. I did the guitars in a studio in Stockholm. I did the drums in New Zealand. Like it was just happening all over the place.
So you'd like get a flurry and be like, get me to a studio, or you brought the equipment with you?
I mostly did it in my hotel room, but I'd go to the studio too.
So the actual mix was recorded in these different locations?
Yeah, and then I'd bring it back to New York and work with John Hill, who's one of the producers on the album, and we'd sift through all the stuff I did and be like, this is garbage, this is
interesting. What are you recording on?
Pro Tools.
Just on your computer?
Yeah.
Wow.
I have a pretty good setup at this point.
That you can travel easily with?
Yeah.
Huh. It's fascinating the way that how seemingly easy it is to have access to amazing technology.
I love it.
Yeah.
And I do a lot of what I do is sample based, so I'll start a song like I Want to Get Better, not to keep referencing that, but only two songs are released. So
yeah.
Like all those piano samples, like that's all cut up and done on an MPC.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my idea for the album. Like a lot of like this super, you know, like created in a box stuff,
mm-hmm.
tied with super organic stuff at the same time, in a literal way.
Right. Well, I mean, that's it's fascinating to me that, like, because I know that, like, if I wanted to, like, I record in GarageBand and I only know how to record voices, is that, like, if I just took an hour or two and learned how to use it, I could probably have a lot of fun with my equipment in here.
Yeah.
But I don't do it.
I hate it, too.
I have to learn the thing.
Learning, if I got a TV, I would throw away the manual right away and spend 7 years trying to turn it on.
Yeah.
And that's my experience. Like, I could, if I spent one day, I could probably make my life way easier.
But someone sit down and show you stuff? Is that the way you are? It's like, dude, you just have to.
I'll be in sessions. I was with Max Martin the other day, actually.
Yeah.
And we were working on something, and I was kind of watching him. I was like, oh, fuck. Like,
you could just do that.
I can do that. And then I save 7 hours every day doing this new thing.
That's great about technology.
But then I have this idea. Like, I don't want to get too good at the computer stuff, though, because I'm scared it'll fuck me up.
Why? In what way?
I don't want to go too far away from just, like, what the song is.
Right. I get that. You want to keep it sort of organic.
Yeah, I don't want to get obsessed with things that not everyone is paying attention to.
Where are you? How do you feel that you finally were able to process the grief? Was it just time?
All time.
All time.
Time and... Well, really just time. You just discover things.
Mm-hmm.
To quote another doctor, I saw a doctor about a year ago in Japan. I was having a panic attack. I thought I was dying. So I was like, I have to see a doctor. This doctor comes to my hotel room and he said something to me, which has really changed my life, about grief, about my body, about hypochondria, about all of it. He looked at me after he took all these tests and I knew nothing was wrong and he knew it. And we were kind of sharing this horrible moment where he was understanding that this was all emotional. He looks at me and he goes, it takes decades upon decades for someone to understand their body. And it like resonated with me so much. And I take that for the mind also. And for everything I've been through, it takes so long to understand it. And you just chip away at it slowly and slowly. And you get closer and closer to not dealing with it, but just being okay.
Right.
You know, just not feeling. My goal for my life is to feel like I'm in my body.
Right.
When I'm at my worst, I'm outside of my body.
Yeah.
And I feel like I live in this place of sort of wavering back and forth, and I'm happy when I feel like I'm in my body. And that doesn't mean I'm not crying. It doesn't mean I'm not terribly depressed or anxious. You know, I like the idea of losing someone, that's forever. Like if someone you love went to camp and they stayed for a week and then they called and said, I'm staying for another week, you'd miss them more the second week. And then they called and said, I'm staying for another week, you'd miss them more the third week. And that goes on forever. But that's human, and that's worth something, but all the fear and the anxiety, like that stuff is what corrodes at you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I just started to think about getting moving on from that.
And also just, like Jews, where did you ever reach into your spirituality at all? Did your family ever?
No.
It's interesting, right?
I hate it.
But oddly, you know, when you think of Shiva or you think of the process of mourning, within a community or
Shiva is a beautiful thing.
Well, it is because there, like, it seems to me that with grief, the emotions are so profound. And if you're capable of stifling them, you know, you will, out of fear of your own emotions and a fear of acknowledging the closure of it. But I think that the idea of Shiva, or the idea of almost, you know, consciously experiencing grief is a profound and healthy process. But I don't know how I would have dealt with it.
It's hard to learn to let yourself go there. Sometimes I get in these like 2 month stretches of not going anywhere emotionally. Then you remember.
Well, it's weird.
Good to go.
I it's not like for me. One of my bigger problems is that because I'm self-involved, and I think people that have the type of panic you're talking about are self-involved, and you've got a lot of voices in your head. Like if that tweet didn't happen, you would have second-guessed it at some point.
Mm.
That it sounds to me like you're doing a lot of second-guessing what you think people are thinking about you, and how to counter that if it does happen, how to put it into a perspective for yourself, how to rationalize it. That's how your self-judgment plays out in your head. So the actual idea of empathy and being able to get out of yourself to experiencing, you know, someone else's pain or pathos or even joy or happiness, it's not instinctual with people who are ambitious and self-involved.
It's not, and it feels good when you can do it.
It does, because you're like, I'm human.
Yeah.
I'm human. Do you do a lot of the music for girls?
I've done things here and there,
but not.
I do like the fun stuff. Like if like when Marnie writes songs in the show, I write those songs.
Oh, okay.
You know?
And do you and Lena try to keep your shit separate as much as possible?
Not in private.
Oh, no. No, but I mean, like, professionally, is there a...
No, we love... I mean, she just directed the video for I Want to Get Better.
Oh, okay.
We do our best job at trying to not give a fuck about all the obnoxious things that people... It's hard to be in a relationship where anytime you say anything about it or do anything, it becomes like a fucking headline.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, there's nothing more awesome than working with the people you love.
Right.
And if media ever, like, dictated something that I wouldn't do that would make me happy, that'd be really sad.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But it's a weird, you know, I mean, she's very famous, and that's a, it's a fucking weird thing.
Yeah.
You know?
But you're handling it?
Yeah, it's also ridiculous. It's like, you know, we have our own life.
Yeah.
None of, you know, we don't do anything to perpetuate any of that stuff, and it's a weird, stressful thing, but we both have really exciting careers, and it'll just be what it is.
It's interesting to see how the culture kind of, you know, out of need for controversy makes, you know, these kind of, these malignant assumptions about people's lives, where you're just sort of like, we're just eating, you know?
And also, like, we live in a fascinating culture, which wasn't the case, you know, it used to be like, Us Weekly stuff and this or that, but the internet has changed everything to just the headline.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the headline just becomes like...
A meme.
Yeah, like someone... There's just a headline that was just like, Lena and I broke up. And that was just the headline.
That was it.
And then the story was that like, someone saw us having a fight on the street. None of it was even true. But like, it just like... But then that's it. That's the headline. Or like when Bleachers was first announced, I remember the Daily Mail in UK just wrote Jack Antonoff leaves Fun, which wasn't true. And then you read the article, and the article was like, Jack has a new band. We wonder if this will be a problem with Fun, which it isn't. But like,
it's just throwing
that question out there is not that. But that's the headline,
right? Because there's such a hunger for content and such a competitive nature to what,
and so much content has to happen so quickly.
Well, yeah, and also they want people to look at it. So like, you know, they don't give a fuck who they hurt or why or whether it's right or wrong, because what's it can happen? A cease and desist? Okay, we'll take it down.
But it has a real impact. I mean, it's like,
sure it does.
People say stuff and then that becomes things that come up in every interview, and then it becomes truth, and it just becomes, you know, it's very intense. I really hate a lot of people who write for stupid websites.
It's the worst. So you want to play some songs?
Yeah, I'll play a song. Let's see. Hey, I hear the voice of a preacher from the back room calling my name, and I follow just to find you. I trace the faith through a broken down television and put on the weather. Man, I've trained myself to give up on the past, cause frozen time between hearses and caskets. Lost control when I panicked at the acid test. I wanna get better. While my friends were getting high, chasing girls down parkway lines, I was losing my mind, cause the love that I gave, wasted on a nice face. In the blaze of fear, I put a helmet on a helmet, counting seconds through the night and got carried away. That's why I'm standing on the overpass, screaming at myself, hey, I wanna get. Didn't know I was lonely till I saw your face. I wanna get better. Better, 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 I wanna get. I didn't know I was broken till I wanted to change. I wanna get better, 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 I wanna get. Up to my room where there's girls on the ceiling, cut out the pictures and I'll chase that feeling of an 18-year-old who didn't know what loss was. Now I'm a stranger, and I'll miss the days of a life still permanent. Mourn the years before I got carried away. That's why I'm staring at the interstate, screaming at myself, hey, I wanna get. Didn't know I was lonely till I saw your face. I wanna get better, 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 I wanna get. Didn't know I was broken till I wanted to change. I wanna get better, 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 I wanna get better. Cause I'm sleeping in the back of a taxi, I'm screaming from my bedroom window, even if it's gonna kill me. Woke up this morning early before my family, from this dream where she was trying to show me how a life can move from the darkness. She says to get better, and so I put a bullet where I should have put a helmet, and I crashed my car cause I wanna get carried away. That's why I'm standing on the overpass screaming at myself, hey, I wanna get. Didn't know I was lonely till I saw your face. I wanna get better, 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 I wanna get. Didn't know I was broken till I wanted to change. I wanna get better, better, better.
Awesome.
Cool.
Thanks, man.
Thank you, Mark.
All right, that's our show from New York, from my hotel room, looking down on Bowery and 4th Street. I'm signing off. This is Mark. I'm Mark Maron. Thank you for listening. No, go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs. Watch Maron on IFC. I'll be in Denver, Colorado, tomorrow night. And right now, what am I going to do? I got to go figure out a place to upload this stuff. That's what I got to do. I'm going to get more coffee. New York, New York, it's a wonderful town. I need one of those machines that change the pitch. Can I put one on here for when I choose to sing one line or something? Boomer lives!
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.